Welcome to the 34 Circe Salon.
Welcome to Make Matriarchy Great Again.
And welcome to the 34 Circe Salon. We are doing our series on Make Matriarchy Great Again, and today's episode will be something that so many people are into, the Amazons. And we're going to talk about the origins of them, the origins of where they're from, what this is about, and just have people understand what their story is. I am Sean Marlon Newcomb, and I'm here with Vicki Noble and Dawn Sam Alden. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Hi.
Could you be so kind as to give a quick intro of yourselves to our listeners?
Of course.
Go ahead.
You want to start? Okay, I'll start. I am primarily a classically trained stage actress, but I'm also a stage combatant, a stunt fighter, a stunt coordinator, a producer, and all other things that are necessary to make work happen in the dramatic arts. I guess that's that's about the size of it.
Wonderful. And Vicki?
And I'm Vicki Noble. I guess I'm probably best known for having co-created the Mother Peace tarot cards in the 1970s with Karen Vogel. But as part of that, the Amazons were very important to me from the beginning of our research. And so I've been sort of tracking them in various ways for 40 years now. In the 1990s, I studied at the British Library for a few days and read everything I could find there on the Amazons. And that's when I really realized that they're not limited. Their tribal presence is not limited to the classical period when the Greeks were so obsessed with them, but that they actually are a female resistance movement, or a resistance movement led by women, led by matriarchal cultures, trying to save the old world. And so we see the Amazons become really visible in the third millennium BCE, before the Common Era.
Can we start right there? Because I think that'd be a great place for people who want to understand their story. You have a quote. Vicki has a book called Double Goddess, which is an amazing, amazing book, and I recommend everyone read it, particularly
Indeed.
If they're interested in learning about the matriarchal foundations of our Western civilization and learning about the Amazons. And in it, you have a quote, "The revolt of women is what transforms them into Amazons." So could we start there? What is, and I think there's another great quote that you have that you might want to share with us. Where did they come from? How did this start? You were just saying they were in the third millennium BC. So,
The third millennium shows us there's Amazon activity that we can see partly by figurines and paintings and other graphics that were the source for my book, The Double Goddess. They're female figures of two women in some sort of authority posture. They're sitting on thrones. Sometimes their bodies are one and their torsos and heads are coming out of the bodies. But they're two women. They're double goddesses. That's what the archaeologists called them. That's what the museum captions say next to these figures. So I got really interested in those figures at the same time that in the material from the British Library, I kept coming across this idea that the Amazons ruled in dual queenship, that they had, by the time we're talking about them as fighters, there in the third millennium, they are a war queen and a domestic queen, or a war queen and a peace queen.
Okay, let's, I just want to have you clarify for listeners. So let's start back with the double goddess. Let's start with where do you first see these images?
Oh, way early. The 8th millennium BCE in Jordan, in a place called Ain Ghazal, very early archaeological site. And the double goddesses there were life-size, and they were made of plaster, but they would have been dressed, you know, and had something for hair and so on. They look a little bizarre because all you see are the plaster forms. But
how are these tied to where we come further forward, to the Amazons and Western civilization? So you find them in Jordan, their images. Where do these images continually play out? Like, do we continually see them, you say, over the next millennia?
Yes, in all areas going west from Jordan. So, and north, let's say Syria, there's a wonderful double goddess pair from Syria. They wear crowns. They look like double queens. And they're from 3000 BCE. These images are all in my book. The images are important. You know, it's hard to talk about them without the images, actually.
I know, I get that. And there isn't much in terms of imagery I can do other than, you know, I've discovered I can put one single image, and maybe we'll use a double goddess image as the picture, the thumbnail for the episode. But, you know, again, for the listener, we're talking about images of two women in rulership positions. And you're saying that we start seeing them very early on and they continue on through, and we're talking primarily about Western civilization, or is this all over the world?
They can be found in places all over the world, but the main grouping of them is definitely in Turkey and Syria, and then Greece and old Europe. So in the West.
So, and they represent, from your research, they represent a form of matriarchal rule.
Yes, exactly. And okay. So taking it way back before there was war, and before there were warrior women, because there weren't warrior people, taking it back to the peaceful civilizations that predate patriarchy, the double goddess is interpreted in various ways, sometimes as mother-daughter, sometimes as sisters, sometimes as a kind of glyph of female lineage, like matrilineage, so that you get the impression of the mother passing down to the daughter, passing down to the daughter, and so on. They've been interpreted in so many different ways. There is even one image from a Paleolithic cave in France that has been interpreted as a double goddess. Even Maria Gimbutas interpreted it that way, but some of the archaeologists and paleontologists have also.
How long do we see this image, from what time period to what time period?
Well, it's still common in the classical period. In Greece, there's a figurine of two women seated on a throne together, and it's called the Two Heras. I think it's from the Archaic period, rather than the classical, maybe it's more like 800, Homer's time. Mm-hmm. So they're still happening then, and probably longer, certainly into the classical period and the end of the first millennium BCE.
So the double goddess represents a symbol of matriarchy, the way matriarchy is ruled, with two women. There were two rulers as opposed to one.
What I'm saying.
Okay.
You know, that's my theory. That's not something that you're going to find in an archaeological book, and it could be argued with. But that's what I've come to believe. There are a lot of there are linguistic things that point to this idea as well. The two ladies. Have you heard that about Crete? they say Crete was ruled by the two ladies. It's kind of a euphemism, I think, for the two queens.
I haven't heard that, but again, for the listener, Crete is the location of what has been called the Minoan civilization. And I know Vicky doesn't like that phrase, and none of us who kind of like follow the matriarchal history really like that phrase, because Minos was king, and it's pretty clear from all the archaeological, all the artistic information from what's called Minos, that Minos very likely was a matriarchy. They also have a language that hasn't been deciphered, translated yet. Surprise, surprise.
They treat King Minos as a historical figure, but there's absolutely not a shred of evidence that exactly. there ever was such a person. They've not found anything, whereas they've found so many images and graphics and stories to point to a matriarchal social organization. For instance, they say King Minos had two daughters. So the king who may or may not have existed had two daughters, and they were called the two ladies. So it's Ariadne and her sister Pasiphae, and there are, you know, there's a lot of legendary storytelling about that Minoan family.
So we have this description of this Cretan rulership, talking about the two daughters, and also the idea that people sort of overlook these aspects of it and kind of focus on this mythical king, which we have no truth of his existence. So there's the rulership in Crete, the two daughters.
And remember, Crete didn't really become the Crete that we think about until the second millennium BCE. It really, right. Somebody went there, you know, the population increased quite a lot in 2000 BCE in Crete. And it really also flourished in some way at that time. And there were new characteristics, new things like mountaintop shrines that hadn't been used before. So I think, going along with my whole idea of the old matriarchal peoples from old Europe, which was the first place that was disturbed by invasions. And so I think those people, you know, fled and became refugees. And this is what Robert Graves said in The White Goddess and in the Greek myths. He talked about the priestesses escaping to the islands with the paraphernalia of the temples. And he even talked about the priestesses carrying round discs with language that were kept in goatskin bags. And, you know, they've found such an important round disc, the Phaistos disc, on the island of Crete in one of the religious centers. So it's very likely true, and we know that people were migrating in droves when the patriarchal invasions began to happen in Europe and then later in other places.
So let me again, I'm going to circle back just for the listener. So we'll need to talk a little bit about old Europe. I need to add, so we can clarify what that's about. But first, just so how does this tie to the Amazons? What Vicky is unfurling for us is where this kind of double goddess queenship rule ties to how the Amazons ruled their own particular civilization, and then we'll get into the Amazons further. But Minos representing, or Crete representing, this kind of matriarchy, one of the last matriarchies, and significantly for the listener, the Minos is also considered the first advanced Western civilization. So you have a pretty tantalizing evidence and argument about Western civilization being founded upon matriarchy. So we'll come back to old Europe, but just to say, Vicky, so that's just keeping everybody aware of where we're tying into the Amazons. The Amazons, in some sense, are in the lineage of these matriarchs, is what you're arguing, correct?
Well, I'm arguing that old Europe, the beginning with the Mediterranean area, when farmers from Anatolia, which is Turkey, moved by sea to Greece. They did that at around 7,000 BCE. We know that from archaeology, and now we know it for certain from DNA.
Right.
So that's the beginning of the goddess civilization in the Mediterranean area. And by 1,000 years later, even less, really, I think 6,200 BCE is the beginning of those farmers who had settled in Greece and built wonderful, very evolved cultures, cities, civilizations, and including the ones that Maria Gimbutas dug at Aquileion and at, I can't remember the other place, Aquileion and the place in Macedonia. But those people, some of them, certainly not all, but some moved north, continued to migrate and moved north to the Danube River. And that they show up there around 6,200 BCE. And from that point, for the next 1,000 years, they develop what we know as the civilization of the goddess that Maria Gimbutas informed us about. They merged in some way with the hunter-gatherers who lived there, and by a certain period later, 700 years or something, the diet of the hunter-gatherers had started to include farm foods. So we know that they, even though they lived next to each other and didn't necessarily merge genetically, they did interact and interchange. So then that development of that early settlement, settlements along the Danube River, that became quite a large expanded culture, which is called the Vincia culture, in the next 1,000 years or so. And that's one of the main areas that we know the most about in terms of what Maria Gimbutas called Old Europe, or what the archaeologists sometimes call the Danube culture. And then there was an offshoot of that even further north and east to the Black Sea. So the Caronival culture and
there's no worries. So the main point is, well, one, we there's archaeological evidence and genetic evidence of what Vicky's talking about. We've seen from the DNA that they found in terms of what they've extracted from the women on Crete, they've connected it to back to Anatolia and forward to Europe today. And this older culture, this old Europe culture, is a goddess-centered culture. It's a culture which we're now going to talk about a little bit. What as it existed becomes into conflict with this patriarchal culture that's coming further from the east and the north, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, and that's where you get your overwhelmed by that, by those invasions.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I was just going to ask Dawn if there's anything that Dawn wanted to interject, because I think for people today, the question of, you know, who the Amazons were and how they existed, you know, we wonder, you know, they're treated as if they're just myths or something out of comic books. So for you, Dawn, what has been the most significant aspect of the Amazon story that you connect with and that you're curious about?
Well, I think the moment that it sort of dawned on me,
there you go. Hold it. Wait, let's see if I have the rim shot. Do I have the rim shot here? I think I do. Hold on.
There we go. Oh my goodness.
It won't stop. Okay.
So many rim shots. The moment that it became impossible for me to accept that Amazons were only a myth, that they didn't ever really exist, is My boyfriend at the time, his mother got married in Rome, and so the whole family went to Rome to attend the wedding, and went through all of the amazing museums in Rome with Greek and Roman ruins and statues and sarcophagi and friezes and all of this sort of thing. And so many of them, were depicting battles with Amazons.
Uh-huh.
I mean, at least 50%, if not more, of everything I saw had some sort of Amazonian presence in it.
Yes, I've read that the Greeks had made more images of Amazons than anything else.
I believe
I've read that as well. Yeah,
yeah,
I've read that
I believe
as well.
It. And, you know, a story is nice and all, but unless they were worshiping the Amazons as goddesses, I find it hard to believe that they made that many images of them if they didn't exist.
Yeah, it's like they were obsessed.
Yes, absolutely. Well,
I have a wonderful quote from one of the scholars that I dug up at the British Library. Her name is Josie Block, B-L-O-K, and she wrote a whole book on the Amazons, and she said this: not only the cult of the mother goddess, but also the matriarchal structure persisted for a long time in certain places, especially on the shores of the Black Sea, in the immediate neighborhood of the Greeks, among the Sindians, the Myotians, the Sarmatians, and in the Crimea, among the Taurians. So that gives us a few places and gives us a long time span, because we're talking about from the 7th millennium in the Mediterranean area, even earlier in Anatolia, and that these people have a lineage that goes all the way down to the classical period. But the resistance that the Amazons really represent, the fighting back, the taking up arms, for people who had not been warlike before that happened, as far as I can tell, in the third millennium. It really became a thing in the third millennium, where there were these warrior tribes. And then we see in the more classical period, like 6th century to 4th century, in east of the Black Sea, north and east of the Black Sea, along the Volga, in Kazakhstan, like that area. In that area, during the Iron Age, they call the first millennium BCE, we find loads of warrior women, burials of warrior women. And those are the real Amazons in terms of what Herodotus was writing about.
So if we're looking at it, if we were, let's say, by chance, deciding to go on our own journey to find these Amazons, we're going to go find their homeland somehow, the route would be you'd start kind of, you'd start with this kind of Anatolian, this centered, goddess-centered culture. You could kind of lead and wind your way up into what's called Old Europe, somewhere around the Ukraine and the Don and all those in that part of Europe. And then you get this clash of cultures with, and we should talk about who these people are that they clashed with, this clash of cultures that disrupts this goddess culture. And then what is spun out of that are these various resistance movements, or this particular resistance movement we call the Amazons, fighting back against the patriarchy. And, and the last thing we see, I should say not last thing, but the most recent chapter, is the stuff that's being unearthed right now, those warrior women burials that they're finding in Russia and the Ukraine. They represent the very, 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 very latest stage of everything, correct?
I would say so, more or less, at least in the Western sense. Now, a lot of the migrations did go east through the north of Iran and to the Caspian Sea.
These are the same women? The same women have migrated from this sort of goddess of Europe into that? Or is it just a different group?
It can't be the same women because it's, you know, 2,000 years later or something.
No, but I mean the same, the lineage. I mean, they're from, their descent is from that earlier group is what I mean.
Their DNA is, these are agricultural people who end up just east of the Caspian, southeast of the Caspian Sea in what's called, I'm having trouble with words today. I'll come back to it. But
but essentially, it's a migration from that area. The way you see this movement of history, and you and I are in accord with this. We both see this movement where it's almost as if, as the goddess culture gets disrupted, the women go on the run, so to speak. And you've got your resistance fighters, and you've got the others that move and continually try to form their own cultures, maintaining
say the women, Sean, it always stops me in my tracks because I've actually come to believe, and we may differ about this, I believe that the Amazons were not tribes of women. I believe they were tribes of matriarchal people, remnants of the old European culture and the old Anatolian goddess culture.
And we do slightly differ on that.
Yeah, and that they were, that they had men, you know, but that they were matriarchal. In matriarchal cultures, you know, men and women are equal, but women as a group rule. That's today, if we find matriarchal cultures today. So, and it looks very much like that in old Europe and in the work of Maria Gimbutas. So in between times, it's hard to say. Maybe sometimes some women did break away, you know, and form coalitions of some kind on their own. But there's actually not, there's folklore about that. There's not real evidence. The warrior women that are being unearthed along the Volga and in Kazakhstan, they're buried in tribal groups with both men and women, but the women are buried at the center of the burial mounds. And some of them are warriors and some are priestesses. And about half of the women are just, they're what Janine Davis Kimball called hearth women, meaning that they, you know, that they have a role at the center in a woman way.
My friend Andrew Luddington calls this zone defense, and I think that's a brilliant term. Sean, you would being a sports guy, you know, the idea of the Amazon warriors, the combat units, were the ones that went out and fought. They were the sort of offensive team. And then the defensive team are the people that stay inside the center of the city or farms or whatever. They're in the center and they're guarding the hearth and home.
Uh-huh. That's nice. Yeah.
There are two things. One, Vicky, I agree with, actually we're in agreement generally. I mean, I think the majority of these groupings are male and female. They have to be. They wouldn't be able to perpetuate. But I think that my belief is that we will find a grouping that represents this kind of very frightening to the Greeks, all female military unit. That's what I think. That's what I'm looking for.
I think that's true. Obviously, if the story of Penthesilea is true, she went with a military group of women and brought her, what would you call that? What's that called? A squadron?
Her troops. Yeah, her squad.
She brought her troops to
her combat unit. Yeah, absolutely.
To Troy to fight against the Greeks in 1200 BCE.
Yeah, I think that's something I think we need to uncover. And as for zone defense, I just can't resist. So people know from football terms, either you can cover your receivers one-on-one or you can cover a particular zone on the field. And if someone crosses into your zone, that's your responsibility. So on defense, you've got to go get the person who's come into your zone and make sure that they don't, in football, catch a pass or basketball, get off a shot. Thank you. I had to get my sports thing in. All right.
Thank you. Thank you for that, because I didn't completely understand what he meant by that, because I do not sports. So.
Yeah. I pretty much sports all day long. anyway, so Vicky, let's link back. Now let's go forward to the Amazons, because I think what we're going to do in the future, there's so much stuff we can unpack here just talking about each of these different realms. But for the listener looking to see sort of a quick overview of the Amazons, let's flash forward. Where do you see this quote unquote, for however they're defined, this Amazon culture developing? What do you see that it looks like?
Male, female, all female?
Where is it? What are they like?
I think you should say matriarchal culture, Sean. Because
I'm wondering for this. The only reason I'm saying that is because that's a good question. Okay, so Vicky, would you agree? Should I say matriarchal and not Amazons? Are there something called the Amazons? Because I think, Dawn, for a lot of people, the kind of excitement is, oh, these Amazon warriors, we've heard this great legend. But do you think there's such a thing that exists?
For one thing, in our culture, we worship war.
Yes.
Yeah.
We glorify it and we worship it. And so, you know, people have generally, in the archaeological field and in the scholarly or the academic fields in general, they've been kind of lukewarm about the idea of these matriarchal cultures that Maria Buddhist unearthed and talked about. And all of us in women's spirituality are gaga over these ancient cultures that were peaceful, because you know, you can't, we a lot of us belong to the peace movement, and people are always trying to imagine or trying to hoping that we can somehow turn things around in the world today and bring peace. But if you can't imagine actually that we as humans have ever been able to do that, then it's very difficult to believe in it as anything other than a myth. And so that we're stuck in that circular way of thinking. And if you look at old Europe and at a place in Turkey, the island of Lemnos has a long, sustained archaeological history, prehistory of matriarchal habitation and matriarchal rule. And then eventually Lemnos has a story, you know, that's really about Amazons, about warriors. But that's 3,000 years after the original Neolithic culture that grew up in Lemnos and was very evolved. So then they obviously ran into trouble. The story about the Lemnos women is that they killed their husbands. The women of Lemnos who murdered their husbands after the husbands came home with Thracian concubines, that is, slave women as booty, from one of their invasions. The people of Lemnos supposedly claim their descent from the Amazon queen, Marina. And later they say another story. This is all very, it's complicated because it's a little bit historical, a little bit mythic.
Right.
But the story of Jason and the Argonauts includes a stop at Lemnos in their travels. And according to the story, Argonautica, they found the island solely inhabited by women who appeared in battle array. So now we're talking about the late second millennium BCE. We started on Lemnos in the Neolithic period, probably 6,000 BCE.
Right.
And now we have we see that Amazons have arisen. Now we have warrior women. And so I love those warrior women, you know, for their intrepid resistance to patriarchy. I believe that, you know, I'm descended from that lineage that we're still resisting today.
Right.
But we didn't start out making war. So early is matriarchal, later is Amazons.
So then, Vicky, let me ask. Sorry, go. Sorry.
Yeah, Sean, let me just interpose something that helps for me to frame this idea.
Right.
When I was in Chicago, we did a derived show called Warrior Queens, and it was loosely based on Antonia Fraser's book of the same name, but it was about women who have led their countries into war.
Ah.
And so we did a lot of research on the various warrior queens in the book and others that aren't mentioned in the book. And one thing that we found that was exemplified in that story of Tamiris versus Cyrus the Great, talked about, Sean.
Why don't you tell that story so people know.
A bloody story.
Well, essentially, Cyrus the Great, who... was remembered as, you know, being great, as conquering a lot of territory, as expanding his empire. And he came across this one queen, Tomiris. And you know, at first he tried to woo her. He offered her his hand in marriage. He wanted her land. And he would try to get it any way he could. And she turned him down. And he tried some skirmishes that were repelled, and then he invited her son to come and stay with them under the sort of heading of, you know, let's be peaceful friends and get to know each other. And I forget the exact details, but somehow while the son was there, I think they essentially kept him under house arrest and wouldn't let him go home. And during the process of that, he was killed. He died. And so Tomiris finally said, you know, I have tried to, you know, be at peace with you. I have tried to just rule my country and let you rule yours. But if you want blood, I will give you more blood than you can drink.
Uh-huh.
And so she raised her armies. And she fought Cyrus the Great's armies and himself in a battle that apparently was so bloody that at the end of the battle, there was about 6 inches of blood on the ground that you had to wade through to get across the battlefield. And she, after the battle was done and she and her forces had won, she scoured the battlefield for Cyrus's body. And when she found it, she cut off his head, and she had a bag, a leather bag with her, that she scooped up the blood from the battlefield, and she took his head, and she stuffed it into the bag, and said, I told you I would give you more blood than you can drink. And what this story exemplified... What this story exemplifies for me and also for our project was that we found over and over and over again that when women ruled countries, they would resist going to war every way and for as long as they possibly could. They would try to find peaceful solutions. They would try to find compromises. They would evade. They would, you know, try to slide out of the trap. But when finally war was inevitable, when they saw that the only way to survive was to go to war, then their goal was not to gain territory, not to teach the other, the aggressor, a lesson. Their goal was to wipe the aggressor off the face of the earth. So this idea of the matriarchal culture only developing the Amazons when it was clear that there was no way to live at peace with these advancing, marauding armies that just kept chasing them from territory to territory to territory, to me makes a lot of sense. That if they had never been attacked, the Amazons would have never been necessary.
Yes. Okay. No, I think that's a great, great point to make because, well, one, I also want to, for the listener, Cyrus was the, of the Persian Empire, one of the greatest kings of the Persian Empire, and Tamaris was from the Masagate tribe, indeed, who, from all the readings that I've seen, seem pretty matriarchal.
That aside.
But the other thing is, keeping it with this, because I think all of this stuff, and I want us to explore all of these, because I think this is, there's, again, so amazing, and this is our chance to kind of get these stories out. But for this particular focus point today, if you were going to look for that kind of mythical, that, that last bit, the resistance movement called the Amazons, Vicky, where, how would you get to them? What would you be looking for? Where would you go? What would be part of the path of your journey? Let's say we for argument's sake, that there may have been this female resistance movement, part of a much larger matriarchal movement of resistance that had gone on for millennia, basically keeping, trying to survive.
Mm-hmm. Well, I look to archaeology for guidance, you know. When they found, I mean, we know that north of the Black Sea, there are lots of female burials in the Iron Age. We know that the place, and as I said, up the Volga, when I went up the Volga River territory with Janine Davis Kimball in the 1990s, we went to one museum after another.
Where's the Volga, just for the listener? Just tell the listener where the Volga
is. In Russia, the Don River flows into the Black Sea and mm-hmm. north, and the Volga River is parallel with the Don. I think it flows into the Caspian Sea, actually. So it's that area in between where some of the burials we looked at were along the Don River. We started in a place called Rostov-na-Dona, right on the Sea of Azov. So that's an interesting place. Up the Volga, there are lots of these burials for a long time there. I actually, when we got to the middle Volga, the archaeologists call it, the area around a place called Saratov, there were horse hoof sculptures, you could say, very stylized female sculptures in the museum from 5000 BCE. And they had little breasts and little belts. And I said, ah, those are Amazons, but they're so early. You know, this is the same territory where the Amazon burials are found later, thousands of years later in the first millennium. But these horse hoof goddesses, as I call them, were from the fifth millennium, so, you know, several thousand years earlier. And it led me to believe that those cultures at that time, even if they're related to the later cultures who became so patriarchal, that at least in the fifth millennium, they were not patriarchal. That was the first thing I understood, seeing those little sculptures, that these were a horse worshiping or a horse breeding culture. They may have domesticated horses so early. We know that domestication of horses happened in that between the fifth and fourth millennium. So so anyway, the Volga River presents an interesting place for.
Can I ask you a question though? There's you said they may have domesticated horses, and you're thinking that this culture may be matriarchal. It's just interesting because one of the myths of the Amazons is that they were credited in the ancient world with having domesticated horses. So it's just an interesting.
That's true. Yeah. Well, that makes sense to me. You know, there's a culture now just recently that they've been very interested in again, because of DNA, new DNA research that's come in. The Botai, B-O-T-A-I culture. They were in the north of Kazakhstan, and in the fourth millennium, they migrated east to the Altai. And that's very interesting because the later burials in the Altai, such as the Pazaryk burial, are beautiful horse-loving cultures that seem quite matriarchal. And there are priestess burials in the Altai and in that area. but they're much later again. They we're talking about a migration out there by these people that they believe now were the first horse domesticators, the Botai culture. But then the later horses that the Indo-Europeans rode and or that they believed that they rode. I mean, I don't think they have too much evidence. They just think the Indo-Europeans were the ones who domesticated the horses that have come down to us as mm-hmm. domesticated horses. So it's two different things, and I don't know all what that means, and maybe those little horse goddesses are related in some way to that early culture, the Botai, or whoever they were before they called themselves that. You know, the thing about archaeology is that the names change in every millennium, even though the lineage of people is still the same, more or less.
Could you say a little more before we come back to going forward, flashing forward of where to look if we were looking now? If you, I, and Dawn were going to go off, who knows, to go look for Amazons and look for this Amazon homeland. Before we get to that, can you say a little bit about, because we've talked about how there were these matriarchies, they're on the run, they're under attack. Who were the people who attacked them? Where did they come from? What were they called? Let's let the listener know a little bit about that.
Well, in a nutshell, they grew up, these cultures grew up on the steppes in Russia. There are steppes north of the Black Sea. They're kind of like grasslands. And then north of that area, there are forests and forest people. The Botai, for example, were forest people. They were hunter-gatherers. The Indo-Europeans were... I mean, the thing is, they're not Indo-Europeans until about 2000 BCE. Before that, they're proto-Indo-Europeans, and everybody, it's a kind of guesswork that the archaeologists are doing and the linguists.
But these are the people who attack you. The Indo-Europeans and proto-Indo-Europeans, you're referring to the group that basically ruptures the matriarchy.
Absolutely. At a certain point, I think probably from greed, I think from coming into contact, you know, they're north of the Black Sea, but not so far, and north and east. And so the matriarchal people, the old Vincha culture is more along the Danube, but the Danube flows into the Black Sea. And there's a site called Varna that was a seaport and in the fifth millennium. And it's at Varna that gold was produced in great quantities. Yeah, the kind of gold, you know, it was even before smelting, I think, when they were still hammering gold. But they found tons of gold at Varna. There's a goddess civilization in that area north of Varna called Kukuteni Tripolia. And they were very, very similar to the Vincha along the Danube and probably related. Pretty much people think they were related. That culture lasted until the middle of the fourth millennium. And it was right next door, basically, to the steppes where the Indo-Europeans evolved. And the two were in contact, and that's the way the archaeologists talk about it. They were in contact. Now, eventually, you know, that contact went really bad for the matriarchal people, and they were wiped out by these others. But the very first invasion, the very first wave that shows in the archaeological record happened in the middle of the fifth millennium, like 4500 around that time, 4600. And that was an invasion around the Black Sea and south just to Varna, just to that area. And they it was pretty damaging. And there were massacres that there's evidence to show that people were massacred, and the gold was a big thing. And then the gold starts showing up in the burials of these Indo-European males. That culture is called Yamnaya.
Yeah, they're the famous. One thing I want to mention too is that perhaps you and I can draw up a little timeline for that we can post somewhere for the listener. I think that'll really help people understand kind of where this starts and when we get down to the classical notion of the Amazons. So we can talk about that perhaps after the broadcast, Vicky. But the other thing is the Yamnaya. The Yamnaya, what's interesting about them is you and I were talking about this. The Yamnaya, if I'm not mistaken, represent the genetic lineage of a large part of contemporary Europe, at least certainly the genetic male lineage.
After 3000 BCE, because that was the huge wave of male Indo-European DNA into the old European farmer DNA. And what it was is it was totally, they wiped out the men. They killed men.
And that's why I was going to bring it up, because now the people, I mean, any contemporary European has a lot of Yamnaya blood. But the interesting thing about it is, we were talking about this, is that they wipe out the men, mate with the women, and you get almost this kind of like deification, hagiography of that brutal rupture. It's like, wow, look at these. It's like they're envisioned as Conan the Barbarian.
It's the beginning of the glorification of war.
Right. Yeah.
And it's the same strategies and tactics that are used today in war. Think of Bosnia and Serbia. Think of what happened with the women getting raped. You know, it's always the same. It's
or Berlin in World War II. I mean, when the Soviets came in, people forget they raped probably about a million German women.
Yeah. My the way it's done.
Yeah, my mother, part of the reason why they lost everything in World War II, my mother was German, is that when the war was, you know, starting to be lost, her father's family comes from an area that is now Poland. And so when the war had started, they had fled out from the cities out into towards Poland to get away from the heaviest bombing. But that was where the Russian troops were advancing. So in order to be captured by the American troops, they actually fled back into the center of the fighting because they knew that the Russian troops were, you know, were going to kill and rape all the way down to little girls. So,
It's so unbelievable, this is, you know, this glorification of war. It's just the berserkers, you know. It's really, it's something that is just not questioned enough in our culture. And I think there's a very profound, a deep resistance to looking at the old matriarchal civilizations that are so, you know, they show quintessential female rule. They show female sovereignty. And there's some way that that's just so taboo in our culture. And there's a hatred that underlies that taboo. And that hatred is what we see that comes out in war in the way that women are dealt with.
It's a very deep taboo. It's exactly it. And it becomes part of the notion of, I think, in any culture, the idea that you could see within your own culture this female predominance really upsets certain guys. And if you're particularly looking at something where a Yamnaya standpoint, which is a very sky god related, if you look at their worship, it's also a glorification of brutality in battle. You look at the genetics where you see and the archaeology where you see these men, so part of it, there may have been not just the only brutality, but they were carrying diseases that people were not able to resist, which is something you see later on in history when you get to the New World.
So you
get this whole horde of pestilence and warfare coming through, and they become the conqueror. History is written by the conqueror, and they're the conqueror who takes the women of the other tribe. So there is that kind of, we think of modern day patriarchal male sensibility of you've dominated not only that tribe, you took their women. So you have that sensibility there. So we've inherited that, or we've had that passed along to us. But underneath it, I think the central conflict that we're talking about in contemporary Western world is you have this matriarchal current, this deep, strong matriarchal current coming up against this patriarchal current, which is grafted on top of it. You know, basically you have its foundation is in this kind of peaceful matriarchal order. And then you have something built on top of it, which is this brutal patriarchal thing. So you have this big clash there, number one. Number two, you get the, I think I've told you guys, the not my wife syndrome, which is right. It's okay to look for matriarchy everywhere else in the world because female power is okay, but not my wife. My wife is happy with me as the conquering pestilence bringing hero. So it's perfectly fine. Don't bring that up in here, not about the West. So that,
hi, honey. Welcome home. Did you bring me some pestilence?
Exactly. It's like, don't bring that up about the West. We can find it everywhere else, but not my wife. She's happy.
Right,
so we've
right.
got a lot of currents.
Well,
that
I mean,
are
if you think against. if you think about it in terms of like generational trauma, now this is, you know, millennial trauma, but if we come from these matriarchal civilizations, originally, these matriarchal civilizations were the one that spread culture, that spread civilization, that allowed the arts to flourish and societies to flourish because it's egalitarian, it's interdependent, the kinds of things that we are able to achieve that we can only achieve when we aren't putting all of our resources into war.
Right, cooperation. They're cooperative
systems. They're... And in a sense, that's a utopia, right? We still think of, when we think about utopian societies, we think of that sense of not having to fight and scrap for everything.
Yes, and so the archaeologists, in their resistance to the uprising of the goddess movement and our independent research and Maria Gimbutas's exquisite archaeological and linguistic research, they say, oh, it's a feminist fantasy.
Right, right.
It's so good. It's a feminist fantasy. And also, you know, it's very common to hear ordinary people in all walks of life saying things like, oh, you know, there's always been war. There's always going to be war. It's the human condition. But my work has shown over the last 40 years that it's not at all true. It's not at all the human condition. For hundreds of thousands of years, we were matriarchal and peaceful, and we knew how to resolve conflict, and we knew how to make sure everyone had their needs met. And it's only the last 5,000 years or so that we've, you know, made this terrible detour. And now we think it's normal.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if the trauma, you know, you said, Sean, that when these Yemenia came in, they killed the men.
Yeah.
And
they wiped out the male DNA. Can you imagine?
So, yeah. Right. So in men, I wonder if there is this sort of trauma baked into men's DNA that says, if you aren't the conqueror, you're the conquered.
And I think that's totally right. We've talked
about
this.
That the fear of a matriarchal culture isn't the fear of women being in power. It's the fear of other men being stronger than you are because you are in a cooperative, peaceful culture.
Yeah.
It could be. That very well could be. There's so many echoes of that. When I mention this to some guys that I know, it's sort of like the first place their mind goes to is how things would be flipped on them, whether it's women flipping them on them or whether it's men from other places flipping them. It's the idea that if I'm not on top, I'm on the bottom. It's the old... I think I can't remember the movie. I don't know if it was Talladega Nights. If you're not first, you're last. If you're not finishing first, you're last.
Well, it's so it's the hill. Remember that game, The King of the Hill?
Yeah. No. Yeah. I think that's where you get. It's a deep fear. I mean, it's a really the kind of thing you're talking about is just these guys flip out at just the mere idea of this matriarchy. And again, I think, like you say, this fear that somehow they're going to be flipped onto the bottom. If they don't keep a foot on someone's neck, then that person's going to get up and knock them out. And, you know, it all goes back to these kinds of fight metaphors and boxing and MMA, which I watch.
Well, if I can dip into profanity for a second.
Go for it.
Okay. I think that, the movie Team America World Police.
Oh, yeah.
Written by Trey Parker and Matt Stone and Pam Brady. They, at the very end of the movie, they sort of exemplify this philosophy perfectly and simply in saying that, you know, there are three types of people. There are pussies, dicks, and assholes.
Wow.
And yes, a dick will fuck a pussy, but only a dick can fuck an asshole. Right? So if you are not a dick, then the assholes are going to win.
Well, and also, if you're not, then you're going to be the one that gets it. Because if you're not using it, then everybody, you know. Yeah,
if you're not a dick, then you're a pussy and you're going to get fucked.
Yeah, it's completely.
So, I mean, this, although it is profane, to me, perfectly encapsulates our current mentality.
I think what would be good, I mean, I know people listening, I want people listening to understand that we want to encapsulate. This is not like we're going off in this, like, fancy scholars lounge, professors lounge kind of discussion. This is pretty straightforward. I mean, just look at your world. Just look at the way politicians react to things, to conflict and combat. Look at TV and movies. I think I've said to both of you, there's a weird undercurrent going on in movies right now. And it's like, there's some kind of like, you know, ritualistic, you know, I'm still the man kind of routine happening here. And you see it, because if you don't display yourself as the king of the hill, then somebody else is the king. That's always the sensibility. So all these things are very real, very practical, and very much in our everyday life. So
that's sort of like the outcome of the patriarchal takeover. But what people always want to know is what made them that way in the first place. How did that happen? If the whole world was a world culture of the goddess, of the great mother, from, you know, we all came out of Africa and we come from basically a single source. And and so what happened to these guys up in the steppes, you know, who turned into the Indo-Europeans? Because there are Indo-European rituals where the teenage boys, basically, the young men are their initiation is to learn brutality. Basically, their initiation is to learn to be brutal. Learn to, so that they think that goes all the way back to the Proto-Indo-Europeans. I was just reading about this from a very renowned scholar, David Anthony, talked about that.
Well, look at the Spartans. I mean, just think about the institutionalized military academy that boys would get. You tear the boy from the mother at seven. You throw him in this military academy. You brutalize him. You brutalize him physically, sexually, psychologically, and you make him into this warrior who the goal was, you're connected with the state. You're connected with your military group. You're not connected with your mother and family. That's where you're brought to.
Yeah.
No, it's they took a seven. At seven, you'd be pulled out, and then you'd be given another boy as your mentor, but that is a brutality mentor, which we don't even have to get into, who would brutalize you in all kinds of ways. So
then go back 3,000 or 4,000 years from that point in the region of the steppes, where so many people, there's so many different tribal peoples living there, some hunter-gatherers, some they domesticated animals and kept herds, nomadic. And how did it happen? It's the million-dollar question. Like, I look at the culture of Varna, and when I hear about how they had a little bit of trade or exchange going on, maybe, or perhaps that's an archaeological myth, and maybe the Indo-European males had already gone into the Kukulcani culture and done some damage, and they may already have stolen women and stolen valuable things, because the valuable things, the gold and everything, shows up in their graves before they demolish Varna.
Right.
So I see it as the reason that they decided to go on the warpath, you know, and go and get the good stuff that that the goddess cultures had created. And of course, all of the gold and silver and copper were originally sacred, and they were used to make sacred implements and sacred objects, and they were part of the priestess tradition. So there was something about those shiny metals that, you know, greed arose. And maybe the women themselves, who knows how they looked. What does that look like when you see women who are free? And I don't know, because
there's a lot. There's a lot of times there's some lack, some clear stressor must have been there. Something maybe where they were running out of food, running out of some kind of sustenance. And also you have that.
There was some climate change. Not enough to explain what happened, but some, and that could have been a stressor, exactly.
Maybe a perfect storm. Maybe you have the stressor, you have the gold, you have the whim, you have all these different things happening at one time. So maybe there is a perfect storm that gives us essentially what world we're living in right now. You know, this eruption of these guys.
So to kind of circle back around to your original question about where, one of the interesting places for us to explore would be south of Varna. Varna's like midway on the east side of on the west side of the Black Sea. So you go down south of there, and that's where the Kauranovo culture existed for, I think, 1,500 years or something. They have a tell that's like 50 feet high where the site was. They built again and again and again and again in the same place. And then that place was completely wiped out.
What's the name of that culture again?
It's called Kauranovo, K-A-R-A-N-O-V-O, Kauranovo. And it's the beautiful pottery and, you know, it's so much of the old European civilization is from the Kauranovo culture. Or at least the site. So anyway, to go down just south of there, then is the part of Bulgaria today, Bulgaria, that's east of the Black Sea, but north of the, what do you call it? The isthmus, that goes from
Turkey to Bulgaria, where Istanbul is around in there.
It goes to Troy. I'm looking at this on a map, and I'm trying to figure out what I'm looking at. It's the Black Sea, but it's the small piece of it that goes over to the west coast, and that area, that southeastern corner of Bulgaria, was
southwestern.
Southeastern. Before you get to Troy, north.
So by Georgia and.
No.
Oh, you go to the other. Yeah, you go to the other way, Dawn. So.
Oh, sorry. Side of the Black Sea. So that you're north. I don't know how to explain it.
But I think maybe the simplest thing, you're in Bulgaria towards Romania. Is that where you're thinking?
No, the other way. We're in
the southeastern
corner of Bulgaria. So it's almost like now we're almost under the Black Sea, but not quite.
Okay.
And that area is Thrace. And the Thracians were like 6th, 5th century BCE. So here's Kauranovo, 5th millennium. And then here's the women's resistance movement still active, the women warriors still active in this part of Bulgaria.
In what time frame again?
They're like 5th century BCE.
5th century, okay.
So millennium to 5th century. It's a really big time gap.
Millennium to 5th
and
century.
And the same is true of Lemnos. You know, the people of Lemnos, I found a great quote from Ivan Marathov. The language of the Kabiri, he says, their mysteries on Lemnos, where the women killed their husbands, was the tongue of the Thracian Sintioi tribe. Okay, so some Thracian tribe in, 4,000 years later, basically, 5,000 years later, 4,000, let's say, from Lemnos to Thrace.
Well, the interesting thing, I need to note that, because the interesting thing is the language of Lemnos, based on what linguists have said now, is tied to the language of the Minoans.
Okay, well, that's very interesting. And also the,
the same language family. Yeah. So if they're also tied to the Thracians, this is one of the, we're going to probably have to wrap up this portion of it, because we're going to go on with this along. We're definitely coming back to this topic because there's so much to dig into. Mm-hmm. But one of the things in terms of our journey of what we're planning is you've got this linguistic connection between the language spoken on Lemnos, the language spoken on Minos. Interestingly, also the Etruscan language, and there's still argument, DNA and archaeological argument, as whether the Etruscans, just the myth was from the ancient world that the Etruscans come from Anatolia. There's some argument now of whether they are an indigenous group, but anyway, it's an interesting link. And now you're saying also this Thracian language, but the significance to me is that all of these cultures were known as having powerful women or being potentially matriarchal, whether scholars dismiss it as being, oh, it's just what they were saying about them in the old days. Of course, nothing about matriarchy is ever true to modern scholars. But the fact that these cultures are linked by language is very significant. And the fact that also no one seems to want to somehow break or decipher the language is also significant. Yeah. So we've got that. But also, you've got the genetic linkage now from the women of Crete, Minoan, to Anatolia, that we have definitively shown where they come from, this same Black Sea region, which is like a cauldron of these matriarchies. So the last thing I want to ask you, though, Vicky, for what we're immediately looking into is we're thinking of obviously looking in another part of the Black Sea, the northern part of Turkey, at the southern shore of the Black Sea. What do we know about that area, and what do you think about its in terms of being a rich place to look?
Well, that's the area we're talking about. That's exactly the area we're talking about.
Right. Well, yeah, we see here, because in Bulgaria we're a little bit further in the other direction, but I'm saying going a little bit further inward towards like Gerson and Samson and the Thermodon, going now in the direction of Georgia, which is also one of the last locations where they say the Amazons, it was one of the myths of where they rode off into the sunset.
Well, that was more like the Sea of Azov, right?
Yeah, well, there's a couple. It's interesting because there's so many different stories. One of the stories is that they're in the hills of Georgia in the Caucasus Mountains, and the other one is across the Sea of Azov too. Like, did they go off there and become Scythians? but we're going to look in this region as well. So there's a lot for us to dig into. I think for today, we might want to just wrap this up and
circle back around as well, thematically, why we're so interested in the Amazons, is that if we believe that they are a myth, then we are believing that women cannot fight back.
Or be strong in general, because in Crete, the women were extremely athletic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. A very good point. And they had the same symbols, right, Vicky? They used the labrus, which was an Amazon symbol.
Yeah, absolutely. It became the symbol, and more than a symbol. I mean, it was the ceremonial motif that represented all of Crete. And certainly before and after the Amazon connected with the labyrinth,
there's a wonderful book by Ellen Snortland, Snortland, called Beauty Bites Beast, and the book is about essentially why don't we ever hear of in the news of instances where women have successfully fought back against their attackers, specifically rapes, specifically when women fight off a rapist.
Well, they go to prison.
Right, right. Well, if they kill them. Yeah. But the idea is that she wants to help us fight the idea that if a man wants to do violence against you, then you're going to have violence done against you. And that sense of the invisibility of the Amazon doesn't protect women. It actually encourages violence against them. Because it makes us easy targets. So the idea of the Amazon is very important to keep alive, because we do still need to be resistance fighters against the patriarchy. And we do need to have examples of when women have successfully fought back against gendered violence.
Yes.
If we're going to keep ourselves alive in this world long enough to hopefully bring some of those matriarchal principles back into our lives.
Absolutely. Well put.
Yeah.
On that note, then.
The Amazons were the daughters of Ares, the daughters, daughters of Mars. You know, the symbol of Aries astrologically is a ram's horns, and the ram's horns, they're everywhere. They're in gold at Varna, and they go all the way down to Thrace. They're very strong in Thrace. I mean, that would be a wonderful thing to follow, to track, because Mars is the fight back.
Right. Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to make our list, not only of the timeline, because I want to share that with people, but Vicki and Dawn, we need to make our list of what we're going to track, because for the casual listener, we are going to look for the Amazon homeland, and we hope to do that soon. So there's a lot of things to dig through. I mean, this is, you know, we've gone on a while, and it's flown by, but yet we've barely scratched the surface of all of this stuff. So,
yeah.
Will you two come back again? Let's talk some more about Amazons. Can we
do
that?
Oh, my goodness.
We'll have
When am I not talking about Amazons?
Exactly. All right. So here is our goodbye music. I want to thank Vicki Noble and Dawn Sam Alden for joining us today in our first of many talks about the Amazons. I am Sean Marla Newcomb. This is the 34 Cersei Salon. Thank you for joining us.